We are here because of the repression against the people. They're starving us to death. Havana is collapsing. We have no house, we have nothing. But they have money to build hotels and they have us starving.
Demonstrators in Cuba over the past few days chanting freedom and patria y vida, homeland and life. That's a play on the old communist slogan, homeland or death. The economy there is in shambles. There are blackouts, food shortages, fuel shortages, plus an unchecked coronavirus pandemic. Now, some of the largest protests Cuba has seen since the revolution back in 1959 that brought Fidel Castro to power. We're going to talk about this with Manuel Pastor. He's a professor of American Studies and Ethnicity at USC. He's done a lot of work on Cuba's economy and the country's relationship with the United States. Welcome back to Press Play.
Always good to be with you.
Always great to have you. Now, you're of Cuban descent. Your father came to the United States in the 1930s, so well before Castro came to power, but you spent a lot of time there. What does this moment feel like to you? Does it feel different from past protests?
Well, it's super significant. I don't think there's been this scale of protest in Cuba, as you mentioned, since the days of the revolution itself. And also, it's a sort of shifting moment in Cuba. First, the Castros are no longer in power. There's a president, President Miguel Díaz-Canel, who is a new president and sort of trying to find his sea legs. And this is a big test of his, power in the country. And then also, it's a big crisis for the country. They've been through economic crises before, but they've always been able to say, at least they've got a public health system that works. Their public health system has been in collapse with this COVID crisis, and it's really sort of taken the luster off what pride they could have about revolutionary achievements.
Didn't they develop, though, a pretty effective vaccine?
They now have an effective vaccine. In fact, it's about 92% effective. They've got two candidates, but they've lost a lot of time. Those two candidates are now just coming off the stage three trials and moving into the vaccination stage. So they're lagging behind other countries which have deployed the vaccine already. And there's been a sharp uptick in COVID cases. Some of this is of great concern because there's also been a food shortage. And because of that, people have been queuing in lines. And queuing in lines outside is going to be a bit risky in terms of COVID transmission.
Right. I understand there are 7,000 new cases a day now in Cuba, which is extraordinary. And as well as you mentioned, these food lines, these food shortages, blackouts. Now, is it worse than it has been in the past when it comes to the economic problems in Cuba?
I think this is about as bad as it's ever been. You know, Cuba went through a very difficult period in the late 1980s when the Soviet Union collapsed. It was a period called the special period because the Soviet Union really propped up about 20% of their GDP. And when the Soviet Union stopped doing that, it caused tremendous economic dislocation in Cuba. Their GDP, gross domestic product, total output, collapsed by about 40% during that period. But they had much tighter political control at that period of time and also much more legitimacy in the country. This is a real crisis of legitimacy for the regime. You know, the slogan that you were mentioning, Patria y Vida, a play on the socialist slogan, Patria o Muerte, a fatherland or death. This slogan means fatherland and life, is actually something taken from a song that emerged last year. And that song, which was a kind of collaboration between Afro-Cuban reggaeton folks in Miami and Cuban rappers in Havana, actually has some really telling lines in it. The most telling line in English is, it's over now, you, 59, me, 2020, meaning that there's a generational issue going on too. You know, for an older generation, the revolution had legitimacy, the Communist Party had legitimacy. For a younger generation that's grown up with tremendous deprivation, that's got high hopes and expectations about what the future might be, and has really just experienced sort of a collapse, this is really a significant moment. I can't tell you how significant it is that that song is being used as a protest vehicle when the chorus of the song is, "It's over now, you 59, me 2020.
Wow, that's fascinating. I want to play a clip of the president responding to the protests, where he blames the unrest on foreign influence, including the United States.
No vamos a admitir que ningún contrarrevolucionario...
We will not allow any counter-revolutionaries influenced by the United States, allowing themselves to be carried away by all these strategies of ideological subversion to provoke destabilization in our country. There will be a revolutionary response. We call upon all the revolutionaries of the country, all the communists, to take to the streets, to any of the places where these provocations are going to take place.
What is he talking about in terms of provocations from the United States?
Well, the U.S. and others have funded some of the civil society groups that have been protesting in Cuba, and certainly there's a hand of the United States to some degree in what's going on. But it would be a mistake to think that this is some intervention that is not building upon an actual sense of frustration and desperation in the country. This is a moment of really crisis for the Cuban Communist Party and the regime. Their public health achievements are in tatters, the economy is collapsed, and there's this tremendous generational conflict and loss of legitimacy. So while there may be some role of the United States in funding some of these groups, perhaps the international aspect that's the most important has been that Cuba over the last couple of years has had access to the internet and the ability to post social media. So one of the things that's gone on with these protests is that people have taken videos and put them up on social media so that people in other parts of Cuba could see what was going on. In some ways, this is sort of Cuba's George Floyd video moment in terms of being able to really publicize what's going on. This is one of the reasons why the Cuban government today basically shut down the internet or access to the internet for Cuban citizens.
Right. I understand they just got 3G mobile phone service 2 years ago, and this was something the president welcomed at the time. And I guess now he's ruining that. And as you say, he has shut it down. Is there anyone waiting in the wings, should the government be toppled, who could lead Cuba in a different direction?
To get back to what you just said, too, I think the president of Cuba has found out that mobile service may be good for the tourism industry, but it's also good for mobilizing people to protest. Yeah. There's not really anything waiting in the wings in Cuba. It's very hard to develop alternative political vehicles, political parties, political forces when there's such control by the Cuban Communist Party and the state. So I think there's not really anything waiting in the wings. In fact, this president was person who was supposed to be waiting in the wings, the person who was going to take the Cuban Communist Party and the state from its period of being dominated by the Castros to being run by a younger generation of Cubans who might be more open to a little bit of political liberalization and certainly to economic liberalization and the invitation of tourists and the kind of opening of the economy, etc. So there's a real possibility of collapse in Cuba. But it's really important to understand that there are so many moments in which people have predicted change and collapse in Cuba. In the special period in the late 1980s, people were predicting that the Castro regime would disappear. That didn't happen. When the Obama administration opened up relationships with Cuba, people were predicting that that would topple the Cuban Communist Party. When Trump clamped down, people predicted that that would topple the Cuban Communist Party. There's a lot of people who've lost a lot of money betting against the Cuban Communist Party and its ability to stay in power. So we just don't know.
All right. But we will definitely keep our eyes on it. Manuel Pastor, thank you so much for joining us today.
Always good to be with you.
Coming up, why Olympic athletes have to sign COVID waivers. That story is next on Press Play.
Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. earn your graduate degree in a flexible online format from University of Southern California, and learn from faculty at the top of their fields in areas such as business, health, law, engineering, psychology, communications, and more. Explore your options today at online.usc.edu.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The opening ceremony for the 2021 Olympics will take place in Tokyo in less than 2 weeks. Even as the city enters another state of emergency, restaurants have been forced to cut hours. The sale of alcohol has been prohibited for the duration of the games. Officials hope these measures will stop large local gatherings. And yet 93,000 people, including athletes, journalists and staff, are coming to Japan. The International Olympic Committee says the games will be safe, but it's also requiring athletes to sign liability waivers absolving the IOC from any exposure to health hazards like COVID-19. Joining us to talk about this is Sally Jenkins, sports columnist for The Washington Post. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
All right. So COVID is hardly in control in Tokyo, and the government last week declared a state of emergency. And so what is the story with these liability waivers?
Well, the IOC has been saying they're going to throw a, quote, safe and secure Olympics in Tokyo on the one hand, and yet on the other hand, they have quietly inserted legal language into the forms that all competitors must sign in order to compete in Tokyo that have very serious liability language that basically say that the athletes themselves will be personally responsible if they get COVID and should die or get, you know, profoundly ill from COVID-19 or any other diseases in Tokyo. And so what you have is you have optics on the one hand and the IOC, you know, saying, oh, it's going to be safe and secure, and yet the substance of what they're doing is inserting legal language about liability that indicates they think there could be a very serious problem.
And also not requiring the athletes be vaccinated.
Well, they don't require that the athletes be vaccinated. They don't have any uniform standards for the athletes or the staffs or the delegations that will be converging on Tokyo, which is a huge concern because of the Delta variant. But I would also add that vaccination is not guaranteed protection from the Delta variant. We just saw last week two members of the Ugandan track delegation testing positive, even though they had been fully vaccinated. And so the Delta variant is a really big concern because vaccination may not be enough protection. And therefore, you could have people going back home from Tokyo, even though they may be vaccinated, and still carrying something back home.
Right. Although it is very effective, the vaccine, in preventing serious illness and death.
Correct. But they'll be potentially going back into populations that aren't fully vaccinated.
Right.
And the Japanese population is, yes, the Japanese population, I mean, the vast majority of Japan is not vaccinated. I think it's only about 6% at this point. And so that's the big concern, is you have a potential super spreader event. You have people converging in large numbers, living for 2 weeks in the Olympic Village, where the dining hall seats 5,000 people at a time, and then returning to countries that have very uneven vaccination standards.
So when did the IOC decide to try to absolve itself of legal liability? Was that a recent development?
It is recent. The language was not in the releases that athletes had to sign going to Rio in 2016. And interestingly enough, what was in the Rio liability waivers was language about ingesting polluted waters. And that was one of the concerns, or getting some sort of other disease, because Zika, as you might recall, was a big concern going into the Rio Games, and so was
right.
The water pollution. And in fact, about 12% of all of the athletes that competed in water sports in Rio did come down with some sort of illness. And again, the IOC said, come on in, the water is fine. And in fact, the water was not. So there is some some track record here with the IOC saying something will be safe at the Olympics and it not being particularly safe.
Well, are they implementing any other measures to try to keep athletes safe?
You know, they have what they call a playbook. They're asking athletes to social distance. They're asking them to bubble in the Olympic Village. But I would add that the Olympic Village is not an especially effective bubble because, you know, in cases like the NBA bubble, you know, athletes had their own rooms. They weren't sharing bathrooms. There's going to be a lot of communal living in the Olympic Village in Tokyo. The suites there are for two to up to eight athletes at a time sharing bathrooms. Again, the dining hall, they're asking athletes to sort of stage their meals in the dining hall. But again, it's an immense dining hall, and you've got a lot of athletes all in the same place, all trying to, you know, compete and live and work and train in the same gyms, in the same dining halls, in the same dormitories.
What do COVID experts make of this playbook? What do they say about it?
Well, they hate it. I mean, I haven't heard of a medical expert who thinks that any of this is a particularly good idea. I think they uniformly, whether you're talking about the medical community in Japan, which is already overstressed and which is deeply resentful of maybe being diverted to care for, you know, an Olympic population in the middle of a state of emergency, or whether you're talking about, you know, people in this country, you know, I haven't spoken to an expert, a medical expert in this country who thinks it's a good idea. I haven't spoken to an agent for some very prominent Olympians is deeply concerned about sending American athletes over there, not just for their own sake, but for the moral issue of potentially participating in a spreader event.
Right. And so I know that they limited spectators. So they're the Japanese government. Are they at odds with the IOC over this and over the supposed playbook?
The IOC is deeply, deeply, deeply unpopular in Japan. And in fact, IOC President Thomas Bach almost doesn't dare show his face, particularly after he referred to the Japanese people today as Chinese.
Wow.
He committed a huge gaffe in one of his first public statements since arriving in Tokyo. He's not a very popular figure. You know, the five-star hotel accommodations that contractually Japan has had to provide to the IOC, combined with the spiraling cost, the IOC, the Japanese people, I think, feel very much the way athletes do about the International Olympic Committee, which is that they are hoarding all of the revenues and offloading all of the risk onto other people, whether it's the athletes or the Japanese people.
Sally Jenkins, sports columnist for The Washington Post, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Coming up, a PBS docuseries looks at Larry Krasner, a longtime defense attorney who is now Philadelphia's DA.
He was an outsider his whole career. You know, in episode one, we have one of his campaign advisors right after he wins telling him, you know, you're the man now. You can't talk about the man. You're the man.
Plus, we'll look at how other progressive prosecutors are faring amid a nationwide spike in homicides. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Before the pandemic, there was a major shift underway in a lot of American cities with voters looking to make big changes to criminal justice and policing. In Philadelphia, Chicago, Boston, San Francisco, and Los Angeles, voters elected so-called progressive prosecutors, DAs, who promised to do things like end cash bail, hold police officers accountable for misconduct, and offer treatment instead of prison for more low-level offenders. Well, now the movement and the ideas fueling it are facing their biggest test yet amid a major spike in gun crimes in nearly every major city. We're going to talk about that in a moment. But first, let's talk about one of the most high-profile of these so-called progressive prosecutors, Philadelphia's Larry Krasner, a former civil rights lawyer who won election in 2017 with this message.
We're going to stop spending money on stupid and start spending it on smart. Stupid is putting everybody you can find into jail. And SMART is putting the money back into schools. It's also putting it into job training, putting it into economic development, because people with jobs don't commit crimes.
The PBS docuseries Philly DA gives us an inside look at Krasner's campaign and his fight to reform Philadelphia's criminal justice system. And joining us now is the co-creator and producer of Philly DA, Nicole Salazar. Welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Great to have you. Okay, so you obviously shot this pre-pandemic. Tell me when you began shooting this film and how long it took for you to get all this footage.
Sure. Well, so the project really began, I would say, in May 2017. And that was when my my two co-creators, Ted Passan and Yoni Brooks, you know, they heard that Larry Krasner was going to run for DA. And Krasner was sort of known around Philadelphia as sort of being, you know, the lawyer to the activists. He was the guy who had, you know, sued the police over 75 times. So when they heard that, you know, that Larry was going to run to try and be the DA, that just seemed sort of like the most absurd thing they'd ever heard. And they thought, you know, this is just going to be a stunt campaign, but maybe it'll make an interesting short film. Despite the odds, he actually, you know, won the primary very handily. So he came into office in January 2018, and we basically filmed, I would say, about another 2 years, almost every day in the office, from inside the DA's office, and then also, of course, you know, from with other people around the city.
Right. So you really do have a fly on the wall feeling when you're watching this. You're in meetings with them as they are really trying to reshape the office from an outsider's point of view. It's kind of a remarkable thing. Like, actually, the fox was allowed to run the hen house, if you will. But as you say, here's a guy who made his career suing the police and fighting the police and the DA, and then all of a sudden he is the DA. How did he decide that this was the route, that working within the system was better for him?
Yeah, that's such a great question. I mean, I really think it just came from him working as a defense attorney for so many years. He just kind of saw day in and day out that the real power in the room, you know, it definitely wasn't with him, and it wasn't entirely with the judge. It was really with, you know, the prosecutor in the room who was bringing the deals. So in Philadelphia, for most of Larry's career, you know, the elected DA was this woman, Lynn Abraham, who, despite being a Democrat, you know, was also known as the deadliest DA in America because of how often she sought the death penalty.
My desire is not only for longer periods of incarceration and for a wedge to be jammed in the revolving door.
In order to keep a job in her office, you had to go for the jugular in every single case.
And so the policies coming out of that office were really, you know, always sort of getting the most amount of people locked up for the most amount of time. And that was sort of what was considered at that time as doing your job at the DA well. So I think that's kind of how he got this idea that, you know, really being the DA is an opportunity to completely reshape the criminal justice system and reorient not just the policies, but also the culture of what people in that office are doing.
What were his major promises when he was elected?
There were a lot of different things. You know, he said he was not going to seek the death penalty, which he has not done. He said he was going to eliminate cash bail. He hasn't entirely eliminated cash bail, but he has dramatically reduced the reliance on cash bail. And he also said, you know, that it was going to be kind of a new era for police accountability in Philadelphia.
Right. And just last month, he issued a report. His office issued a report detailing some of the abuses of power, things like planting evidence and people being in jail for long stretches in some instances because of this fabricated evidence and fabricated testimony. What is his relationship with the police like now?
I haven't spoken to Larry in a minute, but I can say, you know, at least from the time when we finished filming, I want to say it was improving. The main mouthpiece that we often hear is sort of the police union, the FOP in Philadelphia, and they're, you know, they were against Larry before he was elected. They're against him now, and they're very vocal about that. There are many police in the department who don't agree with his policies, but there are also other police officers who do. He was endorsed by the Guardian Civic League, which is the Association of Black Police Officers in Philadelphia. You know, he has 300 lawyers who are working under him, right? And so those lawyers who are in the courtrooms day in and day out, they have their own relationships with the police who are coming in and out of those courtrooms, who are working with them on cases. So, you know, even if sometimes there's a lot of heat at the top, a lot of that day-to-day work really has to do with the relationships of the people who are, you know, who are not the politicians.
Yeah. Well, I guess what's interesting is this idea of their job is to put people behind bars or win convictions, because it doesn't seem like Larry Krasner sees that primarily as his job which is a radical reimagining of what the DA's office is.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, and that engenders a lot of suspicion in parts of Philadelphia, right, which are saying, hey, you're not doing your job.
The no cash bail policy doesn't work, and neither does his ideas of not charging for quality of life crimes, so he can say crime is down, and it's not.
My kids are afraid to walk from 2700 block of Smedley to my mother's at 2800 if she needs sugar and milk.
The police do their jobs, lock everybody up, and Krasner lets him out.
You know, he's kind of disappointing people on both sides, because as as radical as Larry is, you know, he does believe that some people have to go to jail. He does believe that some people need long sentences there. So in terms of sort of the curve of mass incarceration in Philadelphia, it's, you know, undoubtedly going down. It's declining. But there definitely are still, you know, that's the work of a DA's office. Day in and day out, people are still being sent to jail and prison.
Crime is up substantially, not only in Philadelphia, but in most big cities, definitely here in Los Angeles. So I know that you stopped shooting before the pandemic, and you haven't, as you say, you haven't been in touch with Larry in a minute. But there is a backlash now against these ideas. And even among some progressives here in Los Angeles, George Gascon is facing a recall. How do you see that as affecting his mission and the mission of other progressive prosecutors?
Yeah, you know, I think it's so interesting because, you know, Larry just won his primary in May. And in the whole lead up to that, you heard a lot about, you know, there's this backlash. He's not going to just be able to win so easily. You know, the people are really listening to his opponent saying we have to go back in the old direction and all of this. And you really did think, you know, this is going to be a difficult primary for him to win. But then what ended up happening is he actually won very handily. It kind of, you know, put into sharper relief for me that sometimes the conversations that we're having about this at a media level is not really what people on the ground are thinking, what everyday voters are thinking. I mean, I think there is a real concern about the violence going on in cities like Philadelphia and LA and all over. And that's very real. But I think voters are starting to understand that that conversation can be separate and that maybe there's actually, you know, a different approach that still moves us forward, moves us in this reform direction, but then also looks at public safety in a new way.
Right. And so that whole idea gets conflated in the discussion around cash bail and ending cash bail, which is what he also campaigned on, as you mentioned. And there is some frustration on the part of the activists who want to do that, that he's not moving fast enough. And then, as you say, he's getting it from all sides. The other side says, why are you doing this? Why are you letting criminals walk free? Bearing in mind, of course, they haven't been convicted of anything. That's the whole issue with cash bail.
My name is Veronica, and at the age of 52, I was incarcerated for the first time and held on cash bail for 90 days. During those 90 days, I missed the birth of one of my grandchildren. The law claims that you are innocent until proven guilty, but by holding me pre-trial, the criminal injustice system had already decided I was guilty.
So why wasn't he able to get rid of cash bail entirely, which is what I think he campaigned on?
Yeah, I mean, I think he went into office thinking he'd be able to do more than he found that he could. And as far as I understand it, I'm not a lawyer and I'm not an expert, and I've asked lots of people to explain this to me, and it gets more in the weeds of the policy than I would like. But, you know, basically, bail is something that a defendant is entitled to in Pennsylvania. You know, it's written into the state constitution as the only way that somebody who is arrested pre-trial has a right to get their freedom back. So because of this, it being in the law, and it's in the law, I think, in most state constitutions, that's kind of the thing that makes it impossible for him to just remove it.
I guess that goes to the larger problem, the larger, bigger picture, which is there's only so much the DA can do to change the system. How does he view that with frustration? Does he think, oh, there's only so much I can do? Is he more optimistic?
Yeah, I think all of the above. You know, I think he is very much a pragmatist and a realist, and he knows that there's an enormous amount that he can do with the power that he has, but that there's also limits. You know, having turnover across the board, bringing people in who support your ideas across the board, and really by kind of, you know, transforming all of the institutions, that's really how we can take, you know, much more substantive steps forward. Because at the end of the day, even though, you know, there's a lot that he can do on a policy level, he's still elected. You know, another DA could come in tomorrow or next year and reverse all those policies. until the culture of who's in these institutions changes and until we actually change the laws, you know, all of it is somewhat tenuous. And that's also something that I think he understands and why he puts so much emphasis also on bringing in new young attorneys, because he really sees the culture as kind of leading on this.
So I came here to shamelessly recruit. You don't know you want to be a progressive DA until you see what a progressive DA's office is doing. When the pirates take over the ship, you're going to have to change some of the crew.
Yeah, so he goes across the country. There's footage of him recruiting at various law schools, just trying to get people into the DA's office who think more like him. He does say something really challenging and interesting, and it's not a new thought, but it's interesting coming from him and his position, where he says,
so we, the outsiders, need to go inside a government. We need to take it over. We need to make it work for us. Part of my hesitation is I also know that there's danger in holding that power, that there's danger that you become what you fought against.
So I thought that was really interesting, that he saw the limits to what he could do just by the very nature of being inside the system.
Yeah, I was also really fascinated when he said that. And I think, you know, I think Larry, he thinks a lot about movements and what it means to kind of move inside and outside an institution. And, you know, for him, he was an outsider his whole career. You know, in episode one, we have one of his campaign advisors right after he wins telling him, you know, you're the man now. You can't talk about the man. You're the man. And, it really took Larry a little while to embrace that. But I think now he really does understand that he is, you know, for better or for worse, you know, synonymous with the DA's office in Philadelphia. He feels the limits of what he can do. And he also knows that, you know, the change has to come also from the demand on the outside. And there's only so fast that he can move, but he's kind of counting on the activists and the voters to kind of ask for more. And that's what really opens up the space to go even further. So I hope, you know, I personally hope the activists will continue to draw attention to all the things that you just mentioned.
Nicole Salazar, co-creator and producer of Philly DA. It's an independent lens original series, and you can stream it on the Topic streaming platform. It'll return to PBS this fall. Nicole, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
So that's Larry Krasner, one of the first big city DAs elected as part of the progressive prosecutor movement. He's up for re-election again this year. He's expected to keep his seat. He easily won the city's Democratic primary in May. And that primary was seen as a major test for the progressive reforms Krasner and others like him are pushing. Amid a big spike in violent crime happening in major U.S. cities since the beginning of the pandemic, Philadelphia has reported nearly 300 homicides so far this year, and we're only about halfway through. A similar spike is also happening here in Los Angeles. Homicides are up 40% over the same period. While Krasner and his policies still seem to have the support of voters, here in California, similar reforms are fueling recall efforts against L.A. D.A. George Gascon and San Francisco D.A. Chesa Boudin. Here to talk about how a spike in crime is playing out in the overall progressive prosecutor movement is Ayanna Alexander. She covers social justice for Bloomberg Law. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me again. It's good to hear from you.
Well, it's good to hear from you. Well, broadly speaking, how is this spike in violent crime, especially gun-related crimes, putting pressure on this progressive prosecutor movement, on the reforms that these DAs have promised?
Well, you know, with violent crime comes heartbreak behind families losing family members, friends losing friends, communities losing community members. So in talking about, you know, pushback and things like that, you have citizens who are tired of losing people. And each of the DAs that I spoke with when I have covered the progressive movement around district attorneys, they said that's been the hardest part. It's basically adding that fuel to an already fiery dialogue that's going on from the progressive side and law enforcement. I've even heard about conservative forces getting into the mix. And interestingly enough, it's also that I've heard that the rise of crime isn't just in those cities with progressive DAs, so everybody's getting involved. But that's something that a lot of these newly elected and reelected DAs are going to be tackling.
Right. Well, as we heard in the previous segment, some voters are saying, well, they're linking the issue. They're saying, look, we have this violent crime increase. And also at the same time, prosecutors like Larry Krasner wanting to end cash bail. So I guess that's not necessarily linked, because cash bail or the end of cash bail is usually linked to just less violent crime. Right. So how are they able to fend that off and still pursue that particular policy?
That's been really difficult, to be honest, from what I've been hearing from them, you know, is that balance of trying to make sure that they are keeping the people who put them into office happy, keeping them, you know, uplifted, making sure that they're shrinking that footprint in the legal system, right, in criminal justice, while also being somewhat tough on crime. They're just trying to figure out different ways to approach violent crime, and that's been really difficult. I'm not sure how it's going to look in the future, but I think they're also trying to stick to their guns now that a lot of the courts are open, their offices are back open, so they also have to address a lot of backlog that we had in the pandemic, so that's been difficult as well.
Right. Well, let's look at New York City for a moment. The Democratic primary just recently took place, and criminal justice was a major issue. Again, there's violent crime increase in that city, of course. And Eric Adams, former police officer, and he really won on a long law and order promise. He talked a lot about public safety. He defended stop and frisk, for example. So he's expected to win in the fall. And Democratic voters also picked, though, Alvin Bragg to be the new DA, the Manhattan DA, who is a progressive prosecutor. So what do you glean from that?
You know, in speaking with Alvin Bragg himself, it was really interesting. He talked a lot about how he understands the criticism when it comes to violent crimes and addressing them. And he said he's really just trying to talk to voters, talk to the public, while also working with law enforcement, working with the potential mayor. So it'll be interesting to see how the two of them balance that, being that they kind of come from sort of similar but very different backgrounds. Alvin Bragg seems that he has said that he seems to, like he appears to be ready to make that relationship work. So it will be interesting to see how that works. I'm looking forward to, you know, seeing what happens next year.
But what does it say to you in terms of what the voters want? Do they still have an appetite in these more liberal places for progressive prosecutors?
I think it's kind of up and down. You know, I think that there are people out there who don't want long sentences, right? There are people out there who, you know, don't want to deal with that tough on crime mentality. But at the same time, public safety is still what it is. And a lot of the DAs, Bragg included, said that violent crime is a public safety issue and has added that to his priority list. So voters, it's kind of like they kind of want both things. That's the delicate balance. They're trying to figure out how to please everyone, but you can't really do that. So I'm not entirely sure how Bragg will get some of the things that he wants done, but he also seems ready to work with the police on top of working with the public to get both perspectives.
What about the police side of this? Is there any evidence? I know criminologists are still just trying to figure out what are the causes behind this spike in violent crime and homicides. But is there any thought that the police are intentionally not policing in high crime areas because they want to undermine these prosecutors?
So when I spoke to the Fraternal Order of the Police, the largest union, Jim Pasco, he was saying that progressive DAs, yeah, there is a responsibility that they have to this spike in crimes. And that's because he feels like the disrespect against law enforcement is making it so police officers don't want to do their job. And he even said, you know, if both sides play nice, everybody can get along well. But I'm not sure how that will actually play out, how that will work. Because the progressive DAs have a way that they want to do things, and police officers are used to the tough on crime mentality approach. So, but from what I've been hearing from them, it's just they feel disrespected.
Huh. Not to mention that, at least in the Philadelphia case and perhaps in other cities, there's been a renewed push to crack down on so-called crooked cops on investigating coerced testimony, as we explored in the previous segment. So I guess that may be also adding a lot of fuel to the mistrust fire.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely.
So broad, big picture, what do you see happening with this movement in the next year or two?
So from what I've been hearing, there's been a significant shift in the progressive movement. You definitely talked about what we saw with Larry Krasner being reelected or winning that primary. But this is coming off the heels of what appeared to be a national reckoning around racism last year. You know, there are more people coming out and voting for progressive leaders, especially when it comes to prosecutors. I mean, there were, I want to say, maybe 10 progressive DAs that were voted into office or reelected or won some sort of primary at this point, or rallying, people are rallying behind them. You mentioned, we talked about Larry Krasner, despite law enforcement pushback. Last year, we saw Kimberly Fox in Cook County, Illinois. She was reelected. Of course, we've mentioned George Gascon out of LA County. So these progressive prosecutors and reformists, they're elected on the promise that they'll shrink their footprint within the criminal justice system and find alternatives to mass incarceration and focus on that rise in crime and analyze how sentences are constructed, whether that be past, present, or future. Those are just to name a few things. We might see that momentum going, but they're going to have to, I think they're preparing for public pushback, because like I mentioned before, people are tired of losing people. There's a lot of, there's a delicate balance when it comes to being a progressive DA, and they're going to have to deal with that, not only from law enforcement or veteran prosecutors or judges or people in the legal system, but also from the people who put them there. So I hope that they come with their hard hats and they're ready for it.
Yeah, I don't envy that job. Ayanna Alexander covers social justice for Bloomberg Law. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, the spectacular rise and spectacular fall of Planet Hollywood. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Planet Hollywood, the movie-themed restaurant chain with walls filled with props from blockbuster films. Really, a Chili's of celebrity ephemera, a TGI Fridays of Tinseltown. The first one opened in Midtown Manhattan back in 1991. Then another one opened a few years later in the heart of Beverly Hills on Wilshire and Rodeo with a star-studded grand opening. Extravagant, even by Beverly Hills standards.
It's fantastic. Each one is bigger and better. And now we're here in Hollywood. And this is why we made this one the best of all of them.
It's the longest red carpet in history.
I don't know. People love it. They can relate to the stars and shake hands and
I
be
think
there.
They give everybody a chance to just really sort of be excited about Hollywood and admit it.
Brooke Shields, Jean-Claude Van Damme, Cindy Crawford, and of course, the future governor himself, Arnold Schwarzenegger, really the biggest names of the 90s. Let's be honest, Planet Hollywood was always tacky. The kitsch was really the point. And like a lot of excess from that era, it didn't last. Multiple bankruptcies, theme restaurant infighting, and more knockoffs than a Tommy's Chili Burger. Kate Story chronicled the restaurant's 30-year saga for Esquire in a piece called The Rise and Fall of Planet Hollywood, and she joins us now. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Okay, so you write about that Beverly Hills opening. Take us back to that night in September 1995. What was it like?
It was an incredibly big deal. They shut down Rodeo Drive. They put up a red carpet. They had ABC filming a primetime special for the event. What was really kind of special about it, Oprah says it was like the Oscars, only better. And in a way, she was right, because it was, at that time, there weren't a lot of events that got celebrities together other than award shows. And they were just there to have fun. There were no expectations. They weren't really promoting anything. It was a big party, and it was a hit. It was huge. It was a big deal.
Well, how did it become such a big deal? Take us back to the origin story. How did Planet Hollywood begin?
It began with a production assistant who was going through scripts, and he came across a reference to Holly Rock, which was a Flintstones pretend Hollywood world. And he said the idea just came to him all of a sudden to have a restaurant that was kind of like the Hard Rock Cafe, but focus on celebrity and film. And he ran into his boss's office and said, I've got this great idea. His boss was Keith Barish, who was a big time Hollywood producer at that time, who had nothing to do with the restaurant industry. And Keith loved the idea. and said, let's figure out a way to do this. And they found a restaurant partner to bring it to life. And they opened in 1991 in Manhattan. That event was a really big deal. They shut down 57th Street. A big thing that was special about Planet Hollywood is that they had celebrities signed on from the very beginning. So they first reached out to Arnold Schwarzenegger, who was a massive star at that time. They approached him on the set of Terminator 2, and he signed on right away. Next was Bruce Willis, who was also really enthusiastic and offered to play every opening with his band, the Accelerators. And then Sylvester Stallone reached out to them, and the way he described it was that he was on his hands and knees begging that he wanted to be a part of this. So there was a lot of buzz right away.
And so what was the vision, that they would hang out at Planet Hollywood, that customers would be able to catch a glimpse of them, if not, you know, rub shoulders with them?
Yes, the public was kind of promised that they would, maybe they'd be at the next table over when they went out to dinner. And that was kind of some of the excitement for the public of Planet Hollywood, is that this is a celebrity hangout. This is, you know, you could have your burgers and be next to the star of your favorite movie, and there'd be memorabilia on the wall. And that didn't really come to fruition. The stars did go there for opening nights. They did go for the big events, but they weren't really hanging out there.
No, they were going to Spago instead. They weren't going to eat at Planet Hollywood.
Exactly.
But there was an exception that you write about, Stevie Wonder. Why was he so into it?
Stevie Wonder loved Planet Hollywood. He liked to eat along with everybody else in the main dining room. And if it was somebody's birthday, he would go sing with all of the servers, singing happy birthday to the patron, which was a huge hit.
I would love to be serenaded by Stevie Wonder, even if it is in a Planet Hollywood restaurant.
I know. I think the hope of a thing like that happening is what kept patrons going for a small time period.
I mean, it's kind of like playing the slot machines.
Exactly.
So speaking of, was the food always mediocre?
Yeah. I mean, it started, their focus was really on these events. The focus was on memorabilia, which they spent their time focusing on that. The food was always supposed to be mass appeal, burgers, chicken fingers, things like that. But the people I talked to who had to go there regularly for events, I talked to a gossip columnist who went pretty regularly and said that by the food just got worse and worse. By the end, you knew if you're going to an event there, you should eat before you go.
Really?
Yes.
So they weren't lured by the Cap'n Crunch breaded chicken strips.
That was not the appeal.
Okay, so about when in the 90s did it all start to fall apart?
After it went public, I think it was 1996, was really when it started to fall apart. They expanded into so many cities. They also expanded the franchise. They had a ice cream spinoff called Cool Planet. There were a lot of copycats sprouting up in the big cities. There was like a supermodel cafe down the street in Manhattan. Steven Spielberg had a sub shop called Dive at some point. Hulk Hogan had a pasta shop. The idea wasn't novel by the time we hit the late 90s, and it really started to crumble. Keith Barish, who was one of the co-founders, stepped away. I think it was 1998. Then the company went bankrupt twice, and they had to kind of rethink everything at the end of the decade.
And so it still exists, sort of, not to the extent it did, but I guess there are still Planet Hollywood restaurants around.
There are a few. There are a handful. The original celebrities don't seem to be involved anymore. There is a casino, which is pretty successful in Las Vegas. They're actually opening a all-inclusive resort in Cancun. So it does exist, but it's really not what we knew it in the early 90s.
Well, it does say something about the 90s, right? And I don't know if you have a sort of a grand statement about it, what it represents for the 90s, but there is kind of something charmingly crass about it. It seems sort of innocent in a way.
Yeah, it was really kind of fun and optimistic. And yeah, when I looked back on it, it just seems like it was, people had money to spend. They were going out to dinner. They wanted to have a good time. Celebrity culture was different than it is today, and that today we have reality TV, we have social media, so we're seeing kind of the private side in some ways of celebrities in a way that we weren't seeing in the early 90s. So it really kind of captured this excitement about celebrity culture and dining out that made it work for those years, and makes it not as much of an exciting thing today.
Plus they had merch, they had those jackets.
Oh, the jackets were very cool. I had one of the t-shirts and I loved it. I kept it for years.
It's retro chic now, I mean, the 90s are coming back, so why not?
That's true.
We did have the Friends reunion, so.
That's true. Next is Planet Hollywood.
Kate Story is writer-at-large for Esquire, where you can read her piece, The Rise and Fall of Planet Hollywood. Kate, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, that's it for the show today, but I have an ask before we go. We are celebrating the return of in-person concerts, and we have a big prize that you might win. We have just one day left for you to enter for your chance to win a golden ticket sweepstakes, the golden ticket sweepstakes. You can win tickets to, get this, more than 70 live shows, spanning all sorts of musical styles. So don't wait. The sweeps ends tomorrow night. Go to kcrw.com/give. And good luck. Thank you. I'm Madeline Brand, and I'll see you tomorrow.